The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Greetings and welcome to today's episode of Climate Matters. I'm Lindsay Wood, the Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience Limited, and Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South Community Access radio station. As you know, it's also broadcast out across the Canterbury region on Plains Media and to the Rira Rapper on Arrow FM. Well, today we've got the first part of an extended conversation with Dr. Morgan Williams. Morgan is well known around the top of the South, but for those wondering, where do I know that name from? Morgan was the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment from 1997 until 2007. He's also held many other distinguished roles, such as chairing the New Zealand WWF for Nature for 8 years and on the International Council of the World Wildlife Fund for the same period. And he was appointed a Companion of the Queen's Service Order for services to the state and the environment. Morgan, it's a real delight to welcome you to the show, and I'm greatly looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you, Lindsay. It's a pleasure to be here on such a nice, sunny Nelson morning.
It is indeed a lovely morning, isn't it? Let's start with the chat that you and I had in January, which was the catalyst for us getting together today. We were discussing the two successive storms that hammered the Tasman region in the middle of 2025, and you made the observation that our flood defences are based on historical observations and give inadequate consideration to the escalating trends under climate change. Can you please unpick that for our listeners a bit?
Yes, unpicking might be the right word. It's a long story, and I really should declare my ancestry in the space because I grew up on a dairy farm between Kaipo and Rangiora that was regularly subjected to flooding on the flats. Gave me an observation of how you manage that reality on a day-to-day basis. But even more significant in a historical sense was that my grandfather was in Parliament from 1935 to 46, and he was one of the MPs in that period that was very instrumental in the development of and passing of the original Act that formed the catchment boards, which of course became the platform that created the entire river protection system of New Zealand post-World War II. And many yarns with Grandad filled in the background there. And after he left Parliament after the war, he actually was on the first Canterbury catchment board for some years. And much to my grandmother's disgust at times, he took over most of the garden of their retirement house in Kaipoi and planted propagated trees of all sorts to do all sorts of plantings around Canterbury. So anyway, that's my background.
Interesting.
So the point that we're really making here is that we've had a history of extremely good river management in New Zealand through that catchment board structure. And they were independent entities up until the reforms of the late 80s, where the investment in all that work was a 50-50 partnership between central government and the local catchment board and local rating base. When the regional councils were formed, they took over the function of the catchment boards, but they didn't actually take over that 50-50 partnership. It ceased to exist. And so since 1990, in effect, the investment in the renewal, redesign, maintenance, etc., of stock banks and all the elements of plantings and so on, of catchment boards, has all fallen on the local council and their rate base by and large. Why I'm laying out this background is that stock banks are based on history and the history of frequency and intensity So we've got those historically designed and very, very effective. And they were based on the events and severity that communities knew about until basically the post-war period. The point now is that we've got a very different reality in the future from the reality of the past, and that's where we're going to have to relook at our stock banks, and simply building them higher is not going to be the only answer. We have to be much more systematic in how we design the way we live with wilder rivers.
If I can just pick up on what you were saying, and I framed it at the beginning as us talking about the Tasman storms, but this show also goes out to Marlborough and the whole of the Canterbury region and the Wairarapa. And those regions, of course, are susceptible to extreme storm events as well. Have they suffered the same fate with catchment boards as you described in the Tasman region? Is it a generic thing or really just for the top of the south?
Oh, no, it's very much a generic, and it's New Zealand-wide. And we'll come back to that because the Auditor General's looked at this. And really, what has been the increasing challenge for the local communities and their regional councils or district councils is that they, to manage the increasingly severe weather and its impacts in flooding frequency and intensity, there's two things or three things that have become increasingly critical. The first one is the whole warning system of storms, their location, their likely intensity, and their volumes involved. And that's what's starting to vary greatly. And it's why, in fact, here in the Nelson region, there's argument for the need for a better rain radar system. But it's not just that we need. We also, I think, increasingly need, and councils have certainly been working on it, is many more in-site rain gauge systems that are automated and give you real-time data of where you're getting the very intense falls. Because one of the part of the changes is that we're getting these what we call atmospheric rivers, and they stop and drop extraordinarily heavy rainfall in quite limited locations, which literally blow a catchment out and have enormous downstream effects. So it's dealing with this very, very different future that we're in now that's giving us very different river flows, intensities and damage that councils are really grappling with.
Can I just interrupt briefly there? You touched on the fact that the councils are looking at these warning systems. If I recall rightly, late last year, there was, I think, a $5 million award, but funding stream to our region for rain. Is that related to what you're talking about? And if so, is it adequate in the context you're describing there?
Yes, it is relevant. And yes, that money is on the table. The exact sums I don't have top of my head, but there's also insurance money. And I'll come back to that in a subsequent question, because it's quite an important point about how you treat it as an opportunity.
So if we move on from there, and you've touched already on the fact that we're in a new environment from the point of view of predicting and measuring the rainfall rate and storm effects. And I don't want to pitch you as a climate scientist, Morgan, but while many listeners will be pretty climate aware, I don't think there's a general intuitive sense of the escalating trend of severe weather and what is actually driving it. For example, I was critical of Nelson City Council's own current long-term plan being called Beyond the Storm, because that can make what I thought was a dubious impression that the extreme August 2022 rain event was a one-off. And yet we know, even from our own experience since, it's not a one-off. So can you please help us anchor this discussion with a basic extreme weather 101? What are the trends and what is driving them?
Yes, I think, thank you for saying I'm not a climate scientist, because I'm not, but my science is actually in systems and how they link up. And I'm talking about ecologies, economics, values, belief, politics, etc. Because what we're really grappling with here is a systems issue of great complexity. So in terms of a 101, I think everybody who looks out the window or watches the news or wherever they get their information, even on Facebook, I suspect, is now somewhat aware that we've got weather patterns all over the world that are delivering very severe events in flooding, winds, even ice storms, which are all part of a very rapidly changing climate. And the fundamentals for New Zealand that I think probably many people understand is that we're a long, thin island sitting in very big oceans, and those oceans are warming quite rapidly, in fact, very rapidly compared with even other parts of the world. And that means that you get more moisture in the atmosphere. It gets swept on shore, and no part of New Zealand's very far from a coast. So we get these big, damp masses of air sweeping onto New Zealand and dropping very large quantities of rain at sites every now and again. And this is just becoming more frequent, and the intensity and how it's delivered is often becoming more focused.
Sticking with flood planning in the top of the South a bit longer, how we cope with the impacts of extreme weather sits very much in the adaptation and resilience areas of climate responses. If you were writing a brief to guide Tasman District Council in making our future far more flood resilient, what would underpin your strategic approach?
Yes, this is where you get into the are you a sage of the future sort of space? Not sure I am, but it so happens that I got involved with two other very capable individuals late last year who have a deep understanding in two very different areas of the whole management of systems and ecology and well-being of the top of the South. One of them, in fact, is a very major landholder and business leader. And we all ended up having a common conversation and on the common space of concern about really what we were watching evolve in terms of response to the two severe floods last winter. And that actually took us through to saying, well, probably a contribution we could make would be to put our thoughts into a few very succinct bullet points and have a discussion with Tim King, the mayor, which we duly did. And the point that we actually were trying to impart, I suppose, was that we could actually see big opportunities in to get maximum value from the current government investment and insurance papers as we've payments, which to help address the increasing risks of extreme events. And going back to the history of catchment boards, the funding from central government dried up in the end of the 80s. So here was a one-off to do something. So that was our first point, opportunity, and there certainly is. And the second point was we then said that addressing these risks is highly dependent on the skills and processing capabilities of council teams working with their communities. And the point we were making was that the future resilience of the catchments required much more than just repair of current structures, which has been going on very effectively. They've got to be more future-focused with response to high levels of community involvement and a good understanding of all the implications of our changing climate. So we're saying, look forward now because frequency is changing, intensity is changing, the sort of models of stop banks and so on are going to have to be quite different because what we were in fact implying was that looking also at Hawke's Bay's experience, we're going to continue with stock banks, but we're now going to have systems where we decide if a stock bank fails, where can we design it to fail? This is just one example of a response, so that it does the least damage downstream. Because inevitably, we're going to have that, and certainly the Motueka River catchment will have that at some stage. They were very lucky in some ways in last winter that it didn't actually go through Motueka, but history is likely to not be so kind. So, then the third point that we were highlighting, and this is again central to the need, is there appears to be inadequate leadership capacity and capability within the council to cope with these complex tasks. This is exactly what I found in a number of large pieces of work when I was commissioner. The issues wasn't what we know in a technical sense or in an ability to do sense, it's in able to stitch it together. So he said leadership was an issue, and it was the most important strategic issue for the council and the region. And then we went on and said that this lack of capacity extends to engagement with local communities. So it was absolutely clear that there need to be much better engagement with local communities, and that in fact the historical understanding was valuable, because off that you could look to the future quite effectively, and there's some very good and capable people out in all communities. And the other final point was back on positive, was that TDC as a council actually has quite a successful record working with communities in terms of their design of more sustainable systems over in Golden Bay. And in fact, the very long journey from 2001 to the Waimea Community Dam, that had a very, very major community engagement process that drove that very, very effectively. And the final point that we made was that there are other organisations around New Zealand, like Watercare Auckland, that have used boulders as an assembly to work formally with their communities. They bring a group together and work with them around a really tough question. And in the Auckland case, it was, where do we get extra fresh water from? Do we have another pipeline or more dams in the Waitakere and so on? And the answer they got was recycling, which in fact wasn't on their agenda. They didn't think communities would accept that, and that really surprised them. Engineers had ditched that one. So some form of very constructive engagement with your communities is absolutely critical. Anyway, that was an excellent discussion. And at that meeting, the mayor actually said, those points actually are very similar to what I've just read in a draft report from the Auditor General, who has looked at us. And many of your listeners may well know that the Auditor General examined all these matters in the Tasman District Council and in the Waikato Regional Council. And I think it's fair to say they both basically got a D pass. So it's a tough space, but there are many good ways through it. So that was our effort to look at what should be done.
So that's an impressive suite of things, and we formulated very well, thanks, Morgan. Just as an aside, I'm very keen and I'm active in a group trying to promote citizens' assemblies, and so I'm interested to hear you say that. But I just want to close out that item by asking you, what was Tim King's response? Did you get a feeling that he was of a mind to run with what you were suggesting, or was it too early to say?
No, I think to be fair, he certainly heard us loud and clear. But I have enormous respect for the challenges that local government and mayors are faced with them, having seen a good number of examples and having dealt with one for Nelson City Council, which was insoluble for two electoral cycles.
Well, we'll wait and see on that, and good luck, Tim King. I'm going to break this into a three-part conversation. Just by way of closing off the first part, are there any key takeaways for the public that you would most like them to take to heart regarding resilience to flooding and extreme weather events? And I know in the rest of our discussion, we'll come back to more details.
I think the first thing is that they can be planned for. There's no need to see these as an impossibility. There's so many things that we need to know and we can do. And one of the first things in terms of planning for flooding, which my father always talked about, was having some financial reserves, including reserves of feed in places that didn't get flooded and so on and so on. And I'm talking now in addition to insurance. The second thing is to be aware of what the vulnerability of your land use system is. If you've got stock, you can clearly move them. If you've got an apple orchard or a hops orchard, you certainly can't. So that then takes a very different context to planning about where you actually put those in the first place. And that's where history can be very valuable. And I know many in the Motueka Valley are well aware of this. There's a series of terraces there, and you keep on the upper ones, it would seem. So the another factor which is something you can plan for is the nature of fencing on floodplains. I mean, we talk about floodplains all the time. So you now need to anticipate, how do I use this land? And you can, in the knowledge that it's sometimes going to have a lot of water across it. And that's where you have to alter fence design. And there's, I know, a lot of good discussion going on about that. And perhaps finally, but also right at the heart of it, is know your local history. Because I think there's heaps of evidence, both locally and globally, that we tend to forget our most extreme events remarkably rapidly. And that is deeply ingrained in many ways. We take an event and we roll up our sleeves and we manage the mess and move on with life. But the big issue now that is getting really tough is that these are going to be repeat events, vastly more frequent than in the past. So anything that we do that is done in the context, we haven't got another one soon. And I take, for example, Nelson City's $600 per household rate to deal with the big floods of 3 years ago. I do hope that's paid off before the next one arrives, because there will be a next one and it might even be bigger. You cannot think of beyond the floods, if that's the word, because there is no beyond.
I'm totally with you, and thank you for picking that up. I just wanted to pick up on one thing you said there, Morgan, about financial reserves. Were you referring, if you'll excuse the pun, to people having a rainy day fund, or were you meaning more that it was a case for local and central government?
Well, first and foremost, within the land user case, because at the end of the day, they cop the cost. But it's also very obvious now that the funding arrangements between local government and central government for severe climate change events is totally inadequate. And I think there's been a lot said about that.
Indeed, indeed there has. And you will have picked up that this is just the first of three conversations with Morgan Williams, and I'm so looking forward to the other two. For your information, the second one picks up a little bit more on details of forestry, and then the final one is a big jump into the whole question of how our electricity system is or is not working. So I do hope I enjoy your company again for those and for the regular episodes of Climate Matters. And of course, as always, kia kaha for the climate. Now, as you know, you're listening to Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Fresh FM broadcasts in Blenheim on 88.9, to Eastern Golden Bay on 95.0, to the Nelson CBD on 107.2, and across the Nelson Tasman region on 104.8. It's also streamed to the planet on freshfm.co.nz and podcasts of Climate Matters and of other locally produced shows are available through freshfm.co.nz.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.